Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined back on the podcast by one of your favorite guests, who I think possibly holds the record for number of attendances on the podcast. It's Michael Taft, economist, great round, all-around fun guy, and currently economist with SIP2, but brilliant stalwart of economics and progressive economics in Ireland. Michael, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be back on it.
Yeah, no, it really is. It's been too long.
Well, I mean, you know, a little matter of the pandemic kind of interrupted things, but hopefully we'll be soon on the other side of that.
Yeah, hopefully. But obviously, and it, of course, leaves its legacy in many ways, and we're still working through that. And just a reminder to our listeners and to you new listeners who are joining us, we are a completely independent podcast. We have no sponsorship, no ads, and we rely on you to cover the costs of production of this podcast. It does cost to produce, to host, to create, and Tortoise Shack Media is the producer, Tony Groves, who does fantastic work and huge time into producing these. So if you can, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a supporter of the Reboot Republic podcast, help us keep going and producing these podcasts. We know you're really enjoying them. There's a huge value in them. We've had some amazing guests. Some amazing podcasts covering the whole range of issues from housing to inequality, social change, social justice, voices of equality and diversity. So please, if you can, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and become a supporter. Sign up whatever you can each month and you get access to all the podcasts across the Tortoise Shack platform. Michael, the budget is coming up on the 12th of October. This last year, we were mid-pandemic. This year, we are coming out of the pandemic. Where are we in terms of, you know, if we look back at the austerity years, the cuts that happened, you know, the return to economic growth from 2013, 2014 onwards, we've had the pandemic. The fiscal rules have been essentially put aside by the EU, but yet still we have the dominant narrative here. Listening to the debate, it's like to me this weird combination of, on the one hand, you have some commentators criticizing the government for being too flahoolock with the money, like this, claiming that, you know, Varadkar is now a lefty and, you know, making the case for all sorts of increase in spending. And we have the criticism that they're spending more than ever before. And therefore, it's like we have some type of runaway socialist government that is just spending. And on the other hand, then we have themselves saying that we have to keep within the fiscal rules still, that we have to balance our budget. We have Prudent Pascal still saying, we're going to, you know, we're limited in what we can do. What's the truth here? How would you analyze this budget in terms of, you know, is it actually an expansionary? Are we likely to see an expansionary budget? Is it a budget of investment, or is it a budget of continued, more or less, austerity?
Well, I think it's kind of a holding pattern. It's a holding pattern because the government, quite understandably, still cannot predict the route that the public health issues will take. So I think they're kind of in readiness that there could be a downturn in the health of the nation due to the trajectory of the virus. Though that's getting less and less as we go on every day. Hopefully. And secondly, there's still the issue of what sectors will be able to fully recover. And when I say that, you know, there's a lot of businesses that are still in business, but basically because of handouts like the wage subsidy schemes. There's the business subsidy schemes like CRIS. There's exemption from employers' PRSI, exemption from rates. When all those are removed, I think the government is very nervous about how many businesses will start to go under. Will we see a huge rise in bankruptcy and liquidations, et cetera? So we're in a holding pattern, but let's take a step back and look at this debate over what is on offer in the budget. 96-97% of the budget is already set.
Yeah.
We are dealing with at most about 1-1.5% of the budget. That's what's on offer in terms of discretionary expenditure. About €1 billion in terms of social protection and public services. And then there's $500 million in tax cuts. So, you know, there are enormous problems in the Irish economy. What you might call the fiscal elephants in the room. And what we're doing is we're going to chase after mice. We're going to hear all this commentary about, well, how much will tax credits go up? Will there be standard rate tax ban? Will there be cuts here for certain people? Will it be €3 or €4 for social protection payments? And really, that's all pretty small time stuff, considering the challenges to the Irish economy. So that's the first thing is that so much of that. And that's why actually year after year, when the budget is announced, the next day, it's pretty much yesterday's news because it doesn't really amount to much.
And is that essentially your to explain that the amount of money that the government talks about, you know, is it going to put into tax cuts or is it going to put into increased spending, that they're actually, as you say, that's not already set, is a tiny proportion of the overall actual spend? And yeah. Is it in the region of what you're saying, about $1.5 billion for this year?
Yeah, about $1.5 billion, yeah. That's what it's looking like anyway, according to the newspaper reports.
So when you talk about the fiscal elephants then, what are the fiscal elephants?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not sure that I can name them all within the limited time we have. Let's look at the challenges coming down to the Irish economy. First, even before we hit the pandemic, we had considerable infrastructural deficits. And I know that your podcast has dealt with the housing issue on a number of occasions. But yeah, that was even before the pandemic. The year before the pandemic, there were increases in poverty and deprivation, in people's inability to make ends meet. In other words, what looked like there was a continuing gain, social gain, from the recovery, that seemed to stop in 2019. That's the first thing. Obviously, we have to deal with the social damage, social economic damage that the pandemic has imposed on the economy and society. But then let's look at the other issues. There's still the ongoing thing of Brexit that is still causing problems in terms of prices, supply, export markets. And we've yet to fully hit that because so much of that has been subsumed under the pandemic. There's the existential crisis in terms of climate chaos. And the IMF said that we would have to spend probably €1 billion, €2 billion, €3 billion a year more for the next few years just to reach our climate action targets. Then you have, it's very little discussion, and I understand that because, you know, we can only discuss so many crises at one go without getting completely depressed. But there's the ongoing introduction of automation and AI, which some reports have said could impact on like 40-50% of jobs here in Ireland. And then something that nobody is talking about except the forecasters, and that is by the end of this decade, we will be entering into a long-term period of what can be described as an economic drought. Ultra low growth rates in terms of the economy, in terms of employment, which will impact upon wages and will impact upon the government's fiscal capacity to provide the kind of public services that people aspire to. So those are the fiscal elephants in the room. But we
just on the one in terms of the 10-year, what's that 10-year forecast? That
by the end of this decade, we will begin to enter into what can be called a 20-year economic drought. This is part of what is called secular stagnation. Western European economies, including the Irish economy, there'll be an aging process at work. There is kind of, you know, a technological pessimism. You know, will we have the innovation necessary? Issues over resources. And this is not just Ireland.
Does this link back to the kind of the argument that was made that in a sense, the economic growth that happened kind of from the late 1990s into the 2008, that decade of economic boom globally, was in a large part related to what economists of political economy called the privatized Keynesianism. Essentially, it was a debt-fueled, credit-fueled boom based around the expansion of mortgages, that the amount of growth that happened in the real economy was limited, and was a lot of it was based around a consumption that came from credit related to mortgages. And also at the time, you had the rise of what was called financialization, the increased kind of growth of investment in financial markets. And then we had the crash. And really, since the crash of 2008, we haven't seen, and that credit hasn't been replaced. So where are we at now in terms of growth, or what's your sense of that?
That's where this issue of what's called secular stagnation comes in. You're absolutely correct. For so much of that period, a decade, 15 years beforehand, prior to the crash, it was essentially debt-fueled, which was always unsustainable. It wasn't debt-fueled, by the way, by the public sector. It was debt-fueled by the private sector. And quite simply, not so much in Ireland, but obviously we're part of the Western European, U.S. Ecosystem. It was a large part of that was driven by the fact that real wages were not increasing. Wages were not increasing. Therefore, people could access easy money, credit, to make up for the lack of the wage increase. Now what the fear is that obviously we don't want to go back to a credit-fueled, debt-fueled growth, because then we'll just get ourselves in the same problem that we were in before. But what's going to replace that growth?
Is there, though, a question, though, now that, you know, we saw austerity essentially, you know, from after that crash, and that really hammered workers and particularly the younger generations even more and left them with precarious work. And we have the, you know, the inability to buy homes, the increased reliance on rental housing, and we have generation rent now being locked into renting from investment funds and essentially been turned into a commodity for investment funds, that those austerity years, then as we came out of them kind of post, if you look at 2016, 2017, there was that the growth was coming from, obviously, after years of stagnation, you make this point, inevitably you're going to have some growth because when you're contracted for so long. But if we look at the pandemic hit, that states intervened then, and that are we in a new cycle? Are we in almost a post-neoliberal, or entering into a possible post-neoliberal era when we look at Biden in the US, we look at the EU, you know, potential change in Germany? Are states now seeing that they are the ones who can fuel growth through investment?
Well, hopefully that is one potential course that we can take, and that is a political choice, which, you know, we have to mobilize behind a robust and popular agenda to achieve that. Now, it could also be the case that the EU, after allowing this kind of lax of fiscal rules, will reimpose them. Now, they may recalibrate them a bit, but largely reimpose them. Also, too, don't forget, so much of this was driven by finally sensible European Central Bank policies. But that's not a given that they will continue with that, and they may start retrenching. So they might be pulling back on their quantitative easing program, which put in so much money into the economy. They might start increasing interest rates, But here again, the fear, just as the government has a fear in the Irish economy, there is a fear throughout Europe that once the ECB starts pulling back, you know, how many of these companies that were in existence because of this, you know, this what's called a liquidity surge, you know, lots of money floating around the economy. Once that starts getting pulled back, how many of them will survive? And so therefore, I think what you've seen, just like what you've seen in housing, governments have become more reliant upon private capital, especially mobile capital, to provide the housing starts, to provide the rents, to provide the purchases. And we will, you know, there's a potential that we will see this continuing. To give you an example, in childcare, we are now seeing international funds coming in and buying up creches here because they feel they can turn a profit. And they're buying them up in the urban areas, of course, because that's where the money is. Private nursing homes. It looks like the policy of the HSE is to completely withdraw from nursing homes because the number of public nursing home beds has fallen by half over the last 10 years. And there's the ongoing privatization of home care services. So we see in a vital area like care, which is going to grow, we see more and more money coming in. So we have this option. Do we go for the public option or do we, you know, sit back and hope that private capital can come in and fill the markets? The state is left to being just a regulator, but a regulator is captured by these private interests.
I think that's a fascinating point, and it sends shivers down my spine that not only will we have institutional investors, these global funds, wealth funds, extracting people's rent as permanent commodities and generation rent, but then their children, they will be extracting childcare fees from them also as they have their children.
Their grandparents' services in terms of home help and nursing homes.
And home help, the life cycle turned into a commodity by investment funds.
Well, I'll tell you, it's from cradle to grave, you know. I mean, so now.
So are you providing advice to them now? Is it this is what they should develop, a life cycle approach to investment and?
Well, yeah, from the public end, not the private end.
No, but I'm actually going to make a point to you back there, Michael, that if the growth, because the whole question, because you brought it up there about climate, that is it now not the time to actually throw the whole notion of growth and what has been the target of economies, the way economies have been structured around. And this isn't just, you know, radical left-wing economists saying this, but, you know, this is generally accepted now. We have to completely rethink how are we measuring economies? How are we, you know, the whole notion of growth itself, we need to be actually achieving degrowth, that we need to be achieving, you know, ways of development and looking at well-being. So these things like care are prioritized. So why are we wasting resources on sending billionaires into space when we should be developing proper care and public care? That is there, that that's where the debate needs to go.
Yes, I mean, you know, okay, the issue regarding degrowth or no growth or zero growth, sometimes that can get bogged down because people mean different things in different ways. Obviously, we need to grow income to accommodate more and more people. To accommodate investment into innovation and new technologies, but we need to do so in terms of measurements that actually capture what we need to do to survive as a species. To give you an example, if a state were to maintain their rainforest and all the resources needed to maintain their resources, that would count as a cost on the government sheets. It would come under biodiversity or something like that.
Yeah.
If, however, the government auctioned off the land and, you know, people could come in and take all the timber and clear it out for agriculture and use it to sell into timber markets and all that, that would be a boost to GDP.
Yeah.
So, you know, that shows you. I mean, so in other words, our measurements tell us that actually raising rainforests, and, you know, I just use that as one example, is actually an economic good, whereas maintaining them is a cost. But we know from real life that it's just reverse. So we do need a set of measurements that reflect the real life that we're living. And this will not only be in terms of climate change, it'll be in terms of automation and AI. Yes, it's good that we're going to automate more and more, that AI becomes more and more of a player. That will improve the productivity. But if it's
as they take us over and destroy us as a species.
Well, if it just means that more and more people are, you know, kicked off out of the labor market, then obviously that should be considered an economic bad, if you will.
Yeah.
So it's not only about that. So I think that more and more the debate is between two types of markets. One is a private, financialized, increasingly globalized market, where accountability is limited, or we have public markets where there's greater accountability, greater democratic input, and therefore people can, you know, say that, you know, this market will be run in such and such a way that actually creates a social good. And I really, you know, I mean, so I didn't want to get depressing at the beginning part, but if you look at a place like Berlin, the referendum in Berlin on the housing, now I know it's a non-binding referendum, but nonetheless, it will have considerable political importance, not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. And people said, listen, we should just expropriate, private landlords and use this housing for public good. What a very commonsensical and seemingly very popular notion that was. I mean, it won handily. So there are movements, there are ideas that run counter to that. So that's why you say, are we going into a post-neoliberal era? Well, we might well be, but we don't know whether that's going to be a better era or a worse era. And that, as always, is a political struggle.
And Michael, I think there's, you know, something that I always value from you is, you know, your insights into, you know, what's possible and not within the realm of what we consider, you know, what's the word, political possible, or within the debate as presented to us. And I always, you know, value that, because I think it's really important that we challenge and we present solutions and alternatives that go beyond the kind of limits that are put upon us by the current debates, but don't go so far that people think that's ridiculous. How could you ever do that? That, you know, don't jump from, you know, the current system into some utopia, you know, without figuring out what are the steps to get there. You know, and I always have, you know, all through the years that I know you, you've always put some great ideas around. For you at the moment, you know, thinking about the budget, but even beyond the budget, what are the key things that could be done by government and society and our economy and people today that would get us towards cooperative, equality-based social justice society?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that what can do that for us is to continually look at the long term and ensure that what the steps we take today are consistent with the long term drivers of growth. And what I mean by growth, sustainable growth. Give you for an example, one of the main barriers to long-term economic growth is child poverty. Now, you don't get a lot of economists talking about child poverty.
You certainly don't.
Huh?
You certainly don't.
No, you don't. But if you just step back and think about it, and if you were to actually talk to anybody walking down the street, they would see the common sense of this. If a child grows up in poverty, their life chances are limited. If their life chances are limited, their contribution to the society and economy is limited, and therefore we all suffer. Therefore, the reduction of child poverty is a key part of maximizing our economic and social opportunities down the line. Take another, if you, kind of a solution-based thing. I mean, the childcare issue. We've won the triple crown on that. we have the highest fees in the EU. It's about 180 euros a week, as opposed to other countries that charge 30, 40, 50 euros a week. It is a huge drain on families, especially the younger age families who are probably also trying to deal with either high rents or high mortgages. Wages are one of the lowest in the economy. About 60% of workers earn below the living wage. And there is, therefore, a crisis in sustainability because you have a staff turnover of 40%, which means more and more people are leaving the sector because their professional credentials are not earning them money. They're only making about maybe 11.50 an hour. They can make more in Lidl or Aldi than they can in a profession that they studied for and got a degree in. So the solution actually is pretty much right in front of us. And again, it comes back to a publicly accountable market. The state takes over the payment of wages. Now you say, oh, wow, I mean, you can't do that. Well, we do that all the time. In primary schools, the state looks after the wages of teachers. In early education, you know, those 3 hours a day, 5 days a week early education classes that children at the age of 3 and 4 get, the state pays the wages. So pay the wages of the childcare workers, regulate the fees like they do in other European countries. So you've got affordable fees, higher wages, and you've got a sustainable system. Now, you know, every time that we come up against a problem, I think that you have to look for social alternatives, democratically accountable alternatives. And when you pose this to people, they'll say, well, yeah, that makes pretty good sense. You know, so it's about capturing that common sense ground. A simple thing, and I know that you've discussed this so much, Rory, is cost rental. If you were to ask anybody walking down the street, doesn't it make sense for the state to build housing and only charge the cost of the housing to the tenant or to the purchaser?
Yeah.
I say, yeah, that makes perfect sense. This is the frustrating thing to me sometimes about the left. We sometimes get bogged down in grand narratives when actually the solutions that we have, which are derived from those grand narratives, the solutions we have are very commonsensical. And we can win over people to those positions. I mean, I'll tell you this, it's easier to sell the idea of cost rental housing than it would be to sell the idea of the housing for all program, you know, to the mass of people. So, you know, we should look to our strengths.
And just on that, because I think in terms of what was your analysis of the Housing for All plan?
Well, I think, without getting into the kind of the numbers game, you know, are they going to build 50,000? Well, actually, if you look, it's actually only 25 or 30. They're relying on the private sector. What really is the twofold problem? One, supply does not generate affordability. Affordability is a political economy measure. Supply is just a capacity issue. How much can you build? You know, but when you talk about affordability, all of a sudden you're making political choices. So that's the first thing. Additional supply does not equate into affordability. And secondly, I think if you
firstly, Michael, just expand on that one, because that's quite an important one that we're in debates with the other economists with. But if you have a significant increase in supply, surely that will, according to the laws of the market, supply and demand, if you increase supply, well, therefore, you're going to mean people's demand is met and the suppliers will have to drop their prices if they want more people to buy their units or rent them. So surely as supply increases and demand is met, then rents and prices will fall.
Well, two things I'd say about that very quickly. One, yes, that's the kind of thing they teach you in economics 101 class. And you get all these supply-demand curves. And, you know, it's really great. And they usually use apples and oranges. But, sure, they can use workers or housing or anything like that.
Yeah
you get that in there. And when you go to when you go on to do your master's courses or your PhD, the first thing they teach you is all that stuff about supply-demand is nonsense when it hits the real world. Secondly, housing, of course, is not actually a normal market. You cannot manufacture land. There are so many other factors coming in. The availability of credit, the ability to borrow, the location, the type of housing. You may well get a huge supply in the rental market of higher end, apartments and, rental accommodation, because that's where the profit is. But that's not going to affect, most of us, low and average income earners. So again, it is about driving the market in an accountable way to deliver for the majority of people. So that's the issue regarding supply and demand. I mean, to give you an idea, we were building 60, 70, 1 year, 90,000 units before the crash, and prices kept going up. Supply and demand was trumped by easy credit and by the role of, at that time, it wasn't institutions, it was landlords. Now we have to fight institutions. And here's the thing about, for instance, look at the rental part of Housing for All. If you notice, now I read it once, I know you've probably read it three or four times, so, correct me if I'm wrong, there is not one mention in the section on private rents where the government is, as policy target is actually to reduce rents.
No, not mentioned at all. No.
Not mentioned at all. They want to contain the rise in rents, but that ignores the fact that the rent levels already are extremely degrading, not only to the tenants, but to the productive economy. Now, the government's in a trap here, because more and more of that traditional one and two, two unit landlord, somebody who bought something and using it for retirement, they're now leaving the market. And the thing is, the institutions are not coming in fast enough to replace them. So we're actually, there's a decline in the number of rental units. But the problem for the government is that they must continue to ensure, if they are to get this new supply from the institutions, that they have to keep a very high profit margin open to them. Now, if you try to bring about a reduction in rents, sustainable rents, that's going to be a lower profit margin. And in the case of cost rental, it's almost no profit margin. We have one of the highest profit margin levels.
So what would you do? What would you do now, Michael, to tackle the rents, to reduce them?
Well, I would say, listen, the game is up in terms of the private market being able to do that. We have to open up a public market. The Nevin Economic Research Institute, I thought, put forward one of the best solutions. They were building on proposals by the NESC, which is the National Economic and Social Council. So these are not wildly revolutionary ideas, but they proposed that the state build cost rental units for the private market, for the public market, which would be available to all. Because right now we have this situation where the government insists on seeing public housing as housing for the poor. What we need to do is have public housing for everyone who has a housing need. And that means, getting rid of the means test, abolishing the distinction between housing for the poor and then the private market, so that you have a broad-based cost rental system whereby you can dramatically reduce rents. And if there's a problem with supply costs and all that, then actually you just come in and subsidize it. And that's how I would start. I would start from there, because as you expand your market of cost rental units, you put pressure on the private players to compete, and that means they, to attract tenants, they would have to lower their rents. So it has a benefit throughout both markets, both the public and the private. But basically, the state in the future will have to be, through whatever mechanism, through local authorities, to a public enterprise company, whatever, the broad public realm will have to be a significant provider of housing accommodation to more and more people. And to do that, we have to abolish this distinction between housing for the poor and the rest of housing. That's where I would start. That's a public market.
And if you were looking at the budget that's coming up on housing, firstly, what would you do? And then broadly, what are the other key things that you think the government should do in the budget?
Well, on housing, like I say, I would put so it's almost as if affordable housing, as it's called, though sometimes we never get a definition of affordable. And in a lot of cases, affordable housing is just a subsidy to the tenant, which actually me or the purchaser or whatever, which means the price still remains very high. And we just embed the prices into the housing stock. And we subsidize essentially the developers through these grants. Rather than going that route, I would mobilize the resources and make things like cost rental or cost purchase the main driver of housing policy. And therefore, you would greatly expand the development of these schemes, the development of this program on publicly available land, and abolish the distinction with, you know, social housing, which again is seen as housing for the poor. That's where you start. Now, by the way, that's going to take years to embed. So in the meantime, what you have to do is you have to put a very heavy levy and do it sooner rather than later on vacant land, on vacant sites, on derelict stuff. You have to provide the resources for local authorities to CPO these derelict and vacant sites. So those would be those two main resources in the housing area. But in terms of the larger budget, again, we have to take a step back because it's not something you do in one budget. But I think we have to have an option for those on low incomes, whether they're in work or out of work, because raising low incomes is a social benefit and a social good. It can start the economy on a virtuous cycle upwards rather than suppressing them. In terms of the living wage, in terms of collective bargaining, to give people the tools to negotiate higher wages, in terms of linking in a transparent and verifiable way social protection payments to either wages or national income or productivity or some such, we can have a debate about which is the measurement, rather than having this, well, we'll give an extra €3 here a week or an extra €2 a week there. Raising the income floor for all people would benefit everybody above that income floor. And in that sense, you will drive productivity in the economy. In short, what you will do is you will give people the participatory income to go out and reshape society and economy in a far better way.
Yeah. There's some great ideas there, Michael, and you know, it's important that we put them across. Just before I leave you go, what's your sense of the politics and the state of politics at the moment? Do you think the government is governing now for essentially just their voters or who they perceive their voters as? And are they leaving the opposition to those who are being left behind? Is that how they see it playing out? And how do you think the opposition is doing in terms of mobilizing around or, you know, winning people to or convincing people of these alternatives?
Well, first of all, I don't think the government speaks with one voice. I think there's many voices in and there's many strands. I certainly think that Leo Varadkar would like to position Beanie Gael in that kind of, you know, we're the alarm clock party. You know, we're for the alarm clock people. We're the party for those who get up early in the morning and go to work, pay all the taxes and get none of the benefits. Now, the reason, of course, why they don't get any of the benefits is as a matter of government policy. You know, that's something they could change. So I certainly think that it would like to drive that agenda. And, you know, from his very narrow perspective, it's been reasonably successful. I have no idea what Fianna Fáil stands for. I mean, maybe
I don't think they do either.
Well, maybe you could help us out, Rory, and give us an insight or some clue.
I said I don't think they understand either. All right.
Yeah. I mean, they haven't recovered since they took that fateful choice back in 2009, whether to support their working class base, which was always the main component of their broad class pillar, which was so successful going back to the 30s. They either were going to support that working class base or support finance capital. They took a choice. They supported finance capital, and the working class base has just withered and never come back to them. So I think that they are just rudderless, in just even in terms of their history. The Greens, of course, are looking after particularly green issues. Fair enough, that's what they do. But you struggle to find a larger social economic narrative with the Greens. Well, with the exception of some, good people in the Green Party. But they focus narrowly on the green issues. So I don't think that the government has any particular coherent perspective, except, as I say, possibly Leo Varadkar. In terms of the opposition, obviously, if you put together the opposition parties, the progressive ones together, they're looking at something like 40% of the vote, 42% of the vote. That probably would not translate when you get into seats. That would probably not translate into a dull majority, but nonetheless, it's a very healthy basis upon which to build. However, I think that the opposition parties, and they don't necessarily all have to come together to do this, but they should, track one another in this. They've got to move from being opposition to being a government in waiting. Government in waiting is the first step to becoming, or actually the last step into becoming a government. So therefore, they have to do more than just exploit the faults of the current government and the shortcomings and the failed targets and the frustrated expectations. Now, obviously, opposition parties do that, and, it's for a good cause, by the way. No better government to do that against. But they will then have to, to gain the credibility, to gain the confidence, and also to indicate to people what exactly they're going to do. Because if people just vote against one party by voting for another, that doesn't necessarily mean they know what they're going to do. And you could find yourself, again, with frustrated expectations if you actually were even to get into government. So I think that that's where we have to move. And in that way, we can more effectively critique the type of, especially the type of commentary that's coming out. I read in one of the Sunday papers, they're actually suggesting, they're asking the question, has Leo Varadkar become a socialist?
Yeah.
I mean, why? Because he supports occupational pensions? Hell, I mean, Otto von Bismarck introduced pensions back in the friggin' 19th century. You know, there's nothing socialist about that. We have this very skewered debate whereby what is actually mainstream and humdrum and been done for decades in other European countries, somebody suggests, well, we might start a little bit, like the sick pay. We might start a little bit down that road, and they go, wow, really broadening his base, the social democrat is in the house, that type of thing. I mean, we have a very poor perspective on the rest of what the rest of Europe gets up to. And now they're coming under strain as well, but they're starting from a much stronger position than we are. So we'd be in a more effective position to critique that if we move from just opposition to more positive and proactive government and waiting policies.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. And I think in terms of, you're absolutely right around being constructive and being, setting out what would you do in government. And I think that's where we need to be going to in terms of convincing people, because there's no point in just changing a government without having clear policies to be achieved and to have the people and the public behind those ideas as well, because they are going to require changes and they are going to require public support if you are going to make big changes towards equality and social justice. So listen, Michael, wonderful to have you want to go again?
Just one thing. There is a challenge, though. There is a challenge for parties who want to move to a government in waiting. We have to get over this idea that, you know, the public services that we want, sláinte care, affordable child care, free or very low cost public transport, and education, which is truly free and accessible by all. If we want to have those things and the type of in-work social protection supports that is common in Europe, we have to move away from the idea that we can do this by all just taxing the rich or taxing Apple or whatever. We have to have a very open and honest conversation with people about the challenges, the difficulties in meeting things like, for instance, housing, in with the best will in the world, the best intentions, the best policies. It will take a long time, you know, to gain traction, but also to have a conversation about what are the type of resources we need and the priorities that we have to set, because you can't do everything overnight. Now, people, you know, that's about tax increases, PRSI. It's about a whole load of things. But I really do believe this, that if parties went to the public and said, listen, we want to have an open and honest dialogue with you about that, I think the public would really, really go for that. Because I think by now they're kind of sick of these kind of clever games that are being played by politicians. And one of which is this lead up to the budget, whereby, you know, Varadkar, the Taoiseach, is saying, we can give tax cuts, we can give social protection increases, we can increase investment, we can increase money into public services, no problem. People aren't going to buy that anymore. That's taking them for fools. If progressive parties say we want an open and honest dialogue, I think people would jump at it, because it'd be the first time it ever happened in a long time. So yeah. We shouldn't be afraid of that conversation. Obviously, we've got to be careful. We make sure, because the right will constantly try to trip us up and misrepresent us and abuse our positions. So we've got to be careful and tactical. But at the same time, we have to be open with people. You are not going to undo decades of conservative market-led policies within the lifetime of the next Doyle. And it doesn't matter if it was James Connolly and Noel Brown and, you know, Leon Trotsky who were in that cabinet. You're not going to do that. You're not going to undo that in one Doyle sitting.
No, but you could achieve major change. You wouldn't.
You could. Yes,
you could. You could do major things. And I think you're right to point out that it is about, you know, educating, informing and engaging people. And that is about going beyond, as you say, the game of politics to include people. And that's what we mean by a deepened form of democracy, that people would actually have a say and involvement in the economy and government and policies.
Absolutely. Yes.
And that is key. And I think that's an important part of the discussion that should be brought in. I think you're really right to raise that. Well, listen, Michael, thanks so much again for coming on. Always great to have you.
Thanks very much, Rory. I look forward to coming back soon.
Absolutely. We'll have you back soon. That's Michael Taft, economist with SIPTU. And as always, really interesting insights on the economics, politics, and from a progressive perspective. It's great to hear it, the different ideas that are there, and always gives me that extra kick and boost an idea for ideas for hope and change, and also different strategies around that. And just call again to our listeners, thank you very much for listening to Reboot Republic. We really appreciate all of you who tune in. And if you can, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. Give us a rating, give us a support. And it all helps. It all helps promote the podcast, get more people listening, get the ideas out further. It's a lot of this is about, you know, informing people, educating people and engaging them in it. And if you have any ideas for what you want us to cover on the podcast, you can let us know. We're on Reboot Republic on Twitter. And also just a reminder and appeal as well, become a supporter of the Reboot Republic podcast. We've no ads, no advertising, no sponsorship. We're independent media produced by Tortoise Shack Media. Tony Groves doing fantastic work on it. Please, if you can, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Help us remain independent and putting out the podcast that you love. So thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you all again very, very soon.